Hi, this is Marco Pimentel. Welcome to the podcast, Someone Like You. In this first season, you'll discover founders, creators, entrepreneurs, and business owners who are passionate about creating business models with lasting, sustainable climate solutions.
We definitely believe in the rising tide raises all ships, which is somewhat of a terrible metaphor when you're talking about sea level rise and ocean-based solutions. But it's true when it comes to the fact that we need all climate solutions to move forward safely and swiftly.
Coastal carbon capture. To combat climate change, researchers hope that one option is to pull carbon dioxide out of our air and store it permanently in seawater. Carbon removal, a process of taking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and storing it, can be done naturally, think trees, or it can be done via technology, think giant fans sucking air out of the atmosphere. Carbon removal is now considered a must-have tool in our climate tool belt. Even with rapid investment in emission reductions, the United States, for example, could need to remove about 2 gigatons of CO2 per year by mid-century to reach net zero. That's about 30% of US 2019 greenhouse gas emissions. So, what do some of these nature-based research projects look like? Well, that brings me to this week's episode. Joining me is Kelly Earhart, co-founder and director of development at Project Vesta. The mission at Project Vesta is to advance the science of coastal carbon capture, which is the ocean's equivalent of planting trees to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Coastal carbon capture uses the power of the oceans to accelerate the Earth's natural long-term carbon dioxide removal process, and can be accelerated by spreading carbon-removing olivine sand in coastal areas. Kelly is a repeat co-founder with a passion for our planet and is committed to reframing complex issues into applied solutions. In July, Project Vesta launched their very first field project in the town of Southampton, New York, where olivine was spread on a North Sea beach. Here is our fascinating conversation. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Marcos, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. I'm excited for this conversation because it's a pretty big project and business that's being created here and with some pretty big implications. And I think the best thing might be just to kind of start with a little bit about your role at Project Vesta and how Project Vesta came to be.
Sure. So I'm Kelly and I co-founded Vesta. So I am our president at Vesta and have been around since the beginning. So about 3.5 years ago in 2019, I put my head together with some of my co-founders after we all had been working kind of broadly across the spaces of climate and sustainability, or for those of us who hadn't been, we're deeply concerned about the climate. Myself, my background originally was in biology, and then I've applied that through entrepreneurship through my career, working on various endeavors across the fields of climate and sustainability, both nonprofit and for-profit, really trying to uncover really what are the ways in which humans might be able to become net positive to nature again. And after surveying the space of sort of climate solutions, we were asking this question of what are the most potentially impactful solutions that have yet to be taken into the world? What is underinvested in? And a clear winner is the ocean. And a clear winner as well is the field of enhanced weathering. And so what we decided to do was to start Vesta as a nonprofit project at the time, to try and bring the 30 years of lab-based and academic research that existed behind what in academic research is known as coastal enhanced weathering, which is a subsection of a field called ocean alkalinity enhancement, to try and take all of the research that had been done in the lab and bring it into the real world for testing and viability demonstrations to see if we could scale this solution to be a really large-scale climate solution. And so for the last 3.5 years, we've been busy at work doing just that. Excited to share about what coastal enhanced weathering is and why we now call it coastal carbon capture. But yeah, we've grown a lot since then, and we now have a hybrid structure and a really incredible executive team and a much larger team of scientists, PhD scientists, and other scientific collaborators that work with us on a day-to-day basis.
And from, yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned coastal enhanced weathering, and we're talking, you know, we've touched on the show before about carbon removal, and IPCC reports have now, they say it's something that's going to be needed, and kind of, I think it's definitely something that's going to be needed in terms of where and how we get to net zero by 2050 and everything that we're talking about. So maybe when we talk about carbon removal, there's a kind of a host of different type of options. So maybe if you can kind of dive into a little bit understanding what coastal enhanced weathering is and what that kind of form of carbon removal is.
Absolutely. And you're so right. The IPCC report and many other scientific reports as of late have stated that there is just no world that exists where we don't implement carbon removal solutions. And we need to implement them at really large scale in order to make a change and return our climate to a stable place. And you know, we're talking about somewhere between 10 and 18 gigatons or billion tons of carbon removal is needed every year to make an impact on climate change. And this, of course, doesn't come without reducing emissions. It's incredibly important for any of our climate plans that we are reducing emissions as fast as possible. But it's also true that even if we were to return to pre-industrial emissions today and get back to zero emissions, we would still have an immense amount of carbon dioxide debt in the atmosphere that continues to warm our planet for many, many years. And so it's of no question anymore, we need to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And as you said, there's a suite of options for how you do that. Some are more permanent, some are less permanent, some have additional co-benefits. There's a whole world of carbon dioxide removal. But what we're working on is a ocean-based solution called coastal carbon capture. And it's a nature-based process that enhances the ocean's natural ability to sequester and permanently store carbon dioxide. It has the potential to be a billion ton per year solution with co-benefits like lowering ocean acidity and even helping protect vulnerable coastal communities from sea level rise and erosion. And the way that it works is by first taking olivine, which is an abundant volcanic mineral that's found on every single continent. We take that mineral and we grind it into a sand. Then we introduce the sand to coastal areas where it dissolves with the help of free wave energy and tides, ecological processes. Now, that's really important because the use of free wave energy is what makes this process so energy efficient. We can really work with the existing energy of the ocean to dissolve the mineral. And that's critical because as the mineral dissolves, it generates alkalinity in the form of bicarbonate. So basically, it creates baking soda in the ocean. And when it does that, it lowers ocean acidity there. It reduces the ocean acidity, and it allows the seawater to permanently store more carbon as bicarbonate. So it creates a safe way to store more carbon in the ocean and enhance the ocean's capacity to be the natural carbon sink that it is, while countering harmful ocean acidification that we're facing today. And so this process is really inspired by nature. It is a process that is based on the Earth's most ancient form of carbon removal. Our largest carbon sink on Earth is rocks, seconded by the ocean. And there's this natural process that occurs every time rocks come into contact with water called weathering. So as rocks break down, they're always doing this process of weathering and slowly absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And what we're doing is just accelerating that process so that it's not something that takes millions of years to occur, but rather can occur over the course of decades.
And this, and you'd mentioned in the earlier part that this was research that had been done in labs over the last 20 or 30 years, and you've been able to take that academic and approach and start to put it into real life scenarios. So has that begun yet? And have you started to put the sand that has been grinded down into the ocean and starting to be able to see and measure what the effect might be?
We have, yeah. So we, for the last 3 years, have been largely focused on advancing the lab-based studies to continue to test the ecological safety of introducing olivine into new environments, as well as to understand if we can measure carbon removal rates through this process. And what we found in our lab-based studies is additional evidence that olivine is safe for marine environments. And so we have been able to deploy the first ever field sites of coastal carbon capture. We deployed our first site this year in Long Island, New York, where we placed 500 cubic yards of olivine sand alongside of a much larger project, what's called a shoreline protection project, where the community there was experiencing extreme sea level rise and erosion, and were bringing in sand to replenish their coastline. And so we replaced a portion of the sand used for that project with olivine sand, and that is the first site that we've deployed. We have also deployed a very small experimental pilot site in collaboration with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, the U.S. Geologic Survey, and the National Park Service. And that one is in Massachusetts, but it's a very small site.
And where do you get the olivine from? Is that from, you know, certain places that are currently extracting it? Or, like, can you maybe just talk a little bit about just understanding that process of, you know, kind of from rock to sand? Where does it come from? What's the impact of getting it out of the earth and into that form?
Yeah, absolutely. So olivine is found on every continent. It's available all over the world. There's even naturally occurring olivine sand beaches around the world. One of the most famous is Papakalea Beach in Hawaii, where we actually have scientists right now studying it as a natural analog for what we're trying to do. But olivine is not being actively mined around the world because it has a relatively small footprint in the global sort of mineral supply world. It's used as one mineral for a steel making process. And so right now we are working with the existing suppliers of olivine minerals. So for that first site in New York, we actually used olivine from Norway. And that is from the largest olivine supplier. And so that was the supply we used for the first site. And then as we look to our additional sites, we're exploring different suppliers. As the technology itself grows and matures, we're going to optimize for the most proximate location of the source to the site. Now, that being said, because olivine is so abundant, it is often found as the waste tailings of many mining operations. So when you go to mine for other minerals, oftentimes you might have olivine as a large percentage of the ore. So something that we're excited about researching is whether there are ways that we can reuse those tailings, whether there are ways that we can partner with existing mines to do that. So that's an ongoing research question for us as well. The process of extracting it at the site is generally it's quarried. So luckily olivine is often found kind of close to the surface. So it can be quarried. And in many cases, the thing that we're most concerned about from an environmental standpoint with mining is the chemical processing of minerals. And because olivine doesn't require any chemical processing, it has much less impact on its local environment in that regard. And then the last way to answer that question would be to say, you know, what are the, what's the full life cycle impact of mining? So people often want to know, you know, are there embedded carbon emissions in the process of mining this olivine and then moving it all across the ocean to a new site, things like that. And yes, of course, there are a small amount of emissions in that process, but the reality is that they're very, very small. And what that means is that coastal carbon capture is an incredibly efficient process. So it's about 90 to 95% efficient, meaning that we, for every ton of carbon dioxide we emit into the atmosphere in the process of mining, shipping, and deployment, we can sequester 20 times that. So for every one ton, 20 tons are removed from the atmosphere. And as we grow the technology, you know, we'll always look to make it more and more efficient. But as far as permanent carbon dioxide removal technologies go, it is incredibly efficient.
So you have this olivine, you crush it, it's into sand format, you bring it to a coast. Does it have to be set at the edge of a beach? Does it need to be set right into the ocean? How does that work? To, you know, obviously, if you're saying you're using the energy of the ocean, it's, you know, tides, I'm assuming tides and waves, they're probably grabbing it, pulling it back, and then they're sending it down to the bottom of the ocean. And is that storage? Is that how that works?
So we want the olivine in contact with the water. That's the kind of the most critical part. It's generally not our plan to put the olivine kind of where that your beach towel would go. We did put it on the shore in one of our first projects. That was mainly due to the type of site that they had planned already. However, in the future, it'll likely be placed into the near shore, so in the water. But yeah, we want the olivine in contact with the seawater.
And is there any difference about where this would go from, you know, specific oceans? Is it, you know, Atlantic to Pacific to any of that, warmer water to colder water? Does any of that have any impact on that?
So we think that it's likely going to be more efficient in warmer water, higher wave energy, and higher pH environments. We are, again, doing field studies to test that hypothesis and doing a large suite of modeling studies as well to get a really good sense of where the optimal sites will be for coastal carbon capture and then begin making headway towards relationships in those places to actually do deployments. But yeah, it's likely that the process will work best in warmer water.
And for these field projects, obviously, these things potentially take time. How long is it going to take to understand if this method is working properly or that it's sequestering, you know, the adequate amount of carbon? Do you have any indications around that?
Yeah, so from our first field sites, we are already getting some really positive preliminary data back. Now, it's very preliminary, so it's nothing that we would publish just yet, but we are seeing incredibly positive results on the pH change and alkalinity change, which are good markers of carbon removal. So we'll see immediate changes that can be correlated to carbon removal. And we're anticipating that within, you know, 6 to 8 months of a deployment is when we begin having some better information that can be put into publication. We're really excited about the results so far and are going to keep charging forward. We have these first two sites live, and then we have two additional sites that are planned for next year that'll be different environments and give us some different data.
How large are the field projects in terms of just size?
So the size of the projects, the size of where we actually placed olivine sand is relatively small in New York. We think it's going to be able to capture somewhere between 500 and 600 tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So again, not a huge project. Moving forward into next year, we are working on a site that is planned to be about 20,000 tons of olivine, which will capture much more carbon from the atmosphere. So there we're thinking, you know, 15,000 to 17,000 tons of carbon dioxide. And you know, the sites and their size will vary based on kind of the carbon capture efficiency of the place and the unique needs of the site. But in every case, we work really closely with local communities to design with them for these projects.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and a review. Has it been difficult to get the field projects in terms of regulatory approvals? Because I'm assuming, you know, if this being going into the ocean, this is public land and you need government approvals to do these type of things. Has that been a difficult process or one that's been surprisingly, you know, better than you thought?
Well, like anything that you're doing that's fairly new, it's, you know, it has its own difficulties, but what we've done in the United States, we're really just fitting inside of existing regulatory frameworks. So there are existing frameworks and precedent for, again, this field of coastal nourishment or shoreline protection, where foreign sand is brought in to replenish coastlines. And so we fit pretty squarely into those frameworks. And in the United States, you know, we applied for permits at all levels, state, local, federal, and, you know, needed to receive permits at all of those levels, which of course in itself is a lengthy, time-consuming process, but there's clear practice for it. In other places, there are different laws and regulations, and so we always will need to go through the unique local permitting framework. But we're really optimistic about that as we move forward. One of the really key parts of our work that we're incredibly passionate about is our social science side of our work and our community engagement. So we have a site in the Dominican Republic where we've actually been working for the last year. We had a phase 1 permit there, which allowed us to do baseline research. And we've applied for a phase 2 permit so that we can lay olivine sand there early next year. And at that site, we've really centered local engagement and have established a practice of participatory governance where we've gotten to know this community. We've done surveys to understand how they think about climate change, what they think about our solution, and really include them in the decision-making process around it. Have brought in a local leadership team, local community experts, and our regional managers that are from the Dominican Republic, and have a steering committee in place comprised of federal agencies and national stakeholder groups, and have also set up a give back framework so that we can distribute a portion of our proceeds to local organizations there that are working on equitable economic development. You know, this social science side of our work, we think, is absolutely important because, you know, earlier I was just saying that it's quite likely that coastal carbon capture will work better where water is warmer. And that, of course, makes you think, okay, well, they're going to need to work in the tropics and largely in the global south. And if that is true, we want to make sure that communities that we're working with, that their voice is centered and heard, and that it's not an afterthought to hear from them. And so this has been a big part of our research program as well.
And for these programs to kind of scale after projects, the field projects, and let's say, you know, everything is successful and everybody's excited in a specific region, do you think the next hurdle then will be large scale applications where you're putting a lot more olivine into the ocean? Do you think will there be regulatory changes or government changes in order for you to do that?
So it depends on the local regulations. In some places, there may need to be some changes or some special permissions. And then in other places, again, I think we'll fit squarely into existing regulations. So it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. But yeah, our permitting team right now is focused on the United States. And then once we have some of these initial studies back, we'll dive deeper into what it looks like internationally.
And how have you been, how's this been funded? It's, you said you started in 2019. How did you kick this off, and how has it been funded to date? And I guess also, once this looks to be scaled, how will you maybe, you know, take it to the next step for funding as well?
Yeah, so we started in 2019 as a small nonprofit project and raised philanthropic funding to kind of kick off our initial research. And our philanthropic supporters are really who held up our research program for the first couple of years. And then at the end of last year, we actually stood up a public benefit corporation, which is a legal entity in the United States that is a corporate company, but a corporate company structure, but it has the ability to prioritize legally mission over profit. And so we have this public benefit corporation as one side of our business, but we actually have a hybrid model where we also still have a relationship with a sister nonprofit fund that funds the execution of the research that we're doing. Because right now, the majority of our work and our research is all being published into the public benefit so that the whole field of scientists and the global community can benefit from the research that we're doing on coastal carbon capture today. Now there is also necessary sort of business development that needs to be done so that if we have continued to have positive results in the field, there is a sustainable business model that can come in and bring this work to scale in the world. And so we have the public benefit corporation built just for that, so that we can, you know, create things like intellectual property and research and develop different technologies and supply chain partnerships and commercial partnerships so that we can fund this work long-term and large scale. So we have raised both philanthropic funds and equity from impact investors to do this work. And now we're also working on some innovative financing structures through program-related investments, which are ways that philanthropists can actually make loans to companies that can be recovered and then put back into their philanthropy to be re-granted on the basis of the projects that we're doing. So we're exploring a lot of sort of innovative hybrid financing techniques so that we can accomplish both things, you know, getting the science out there and into the world, into the hands of all, while also developing something that can really grow the business in the future.
And do you, when we talk about the business side as well, do you anticipate to monetize the, you know, I guess, is it the intellectual property? Is it the, you know, the consulting side of it? Or do you want to build a pathway to monetize carbon removal and the selling of carbon removal? Like, is that one of the paths forward?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so the main path forward is selling carbon removal on the basis of our work. So working with companies who, you know, are voluntarily buying carbon removal on the back of their commitments to reduce emissions, and while at reducing emissions, purchasing carbon removal. So we're selling carbon removal, and we have pre-sold a number of credits already. And then, you know, there will be in the future, we anticipate there will be some licensing of the technology as well, and possibly even the sale of sand. But those two are smaller elements of the business that we have yet to develop. So for right now, mainly carbon removal sales.
How important is the kind of commitment or the early purchasing of carbon removal from your company in terms of, you know, you hear this quite often where if some of these leading options in carbon removal or carbon technology had longer term or opportunistic commitments of, let's say, X carbon price per ton for 5 years commitment or 10 years for this much type of volume, that really helps to accelerate younger technology to have a little bit more conviction in what they're doing and commitment to what they're doing because they know that there's the funds there in the future. Is that incredibly important for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it can be likened a lot to the way that renewable energy was able to be pushed forward through what are called power purchase agreements. So the commitment to purchase renewable energy from a new supplier over the course of a 20-year period. What that allowed companies to do was to go to their financing parties and say, hey, look, we have this pre-booked revenue. And today in the carbon market, we have these things that are becoming more popular in the news and in the field called advanced market commitments, where entities like Frontier, which is a large commitment that was made by a series of big tech companies like Alphabet and Stripe and Shopify, McKinsey and Meta, that committed almost $1 billion to purchasing carbon removal through advanced market commitments, so that carbon removal technology companies can have, again, that sort of pre-booked revenue that we can go to our financing partners and show that there's solvency for this business, there's market fit, and this is something that's good to invest in.
It's early, obviously, in the process that you're in, but you hear $7 for carbon removal for things like, some monoculture type of tree planting, upwards of $1,000 for direct air capture. Where do you think early numbers will be for coastal carbon capture in terms of a cost?
So that's one of the most exciting things about coastal carbon capture is the scalability and the future affordability of the solution. Because some of the solutions that are available today, and really any of the permanent solutions that are available today, just do not have any line of sight to costs that go below a couple hundred dollars per ton. And that is hard to imagine scaling to meet our global goals. So today, coastal carbon capture credits are expensive because they were paying for some very, very small pilot sites. And as you can imagine, there are no economies of scale present at these sites. So today, our costs are about $750 a ton. But at even just our next level of deployment, we see those costs go down, almost an order of magnitude. And at full scale, what we're aiming for is being able to deliver carbon removal at a cost of as low as potentially $35 per ton. So it would make it incredibly, incredibly affordable compared to any other permanent removal solution, while also being energy efficient and providing some key co-benefits.
Wow. Yeah, those are pretty convicting type of numbers in terms of that type of range. And what's the competitive landscape right now? Is there, you talk about really having the nonprofit side to really enhance the research so that hopefully this kind of brings out a new option and hopefully it works. And is there a competitive landscape right now, or how much research is being done in this field?
I think in some ways there, you could call it a competitive landscape, but we very much don't see it like that. We definitely believe in the rising tide raises all ships, which is somewhat of a terrible metaphor when you're talking about sea level rise and ocean-based solutions. But it's true when it comes to the fact that we need all climate solutions to move forward safely and swiftly, with appropriate research. And so we definitely commend all efforts that are ongoing in the space. And there's tons of ways to remove carbon from the atmosphere, and they all have their different merits and they all have their drawbacks. And I think it's important that they're brought into the market, again, in a safe way, having been properly researched, and in the right sort of size and fit. With that being said, in our specific field, there are some others that are researching coastal enhanced weathering. And in the broader field of ocean alkalinity enhancement, there are a couple of companies that have come online that are doing a different form of ocean alkalinity enhancement, where they're actually doing more of an industrial process co-located with mines and at the ocean, where they're injecting our alkalinity into the ocean through an electrolysis process. So it's a very different process than what we're doing, but ultimately it is ocean alkalinity enhancement. We are the first ever to do any field trial of any ocean alkalinity enhancement solution. So we've really kind of made history recently in being able to deploy the first field project. In the field of coastal enhanced weathering, again, there are many academic institutions and research organizations that are researching this in labs and in mesocosms and microcosms, which are simulations of the Earth environment. But we're really proud to have deployed the first field sites, which was agreed by all was the next step in this research that had been ongoing for so long. The National Academy of Sciences wrote a report at the end of last year on ocean-based carbon removal. And in it, they called for field trials of ocean alkalinity enhancement. And they actually mentioned us by name. So it was really exciting to be able to deliver on those this summer.
Well, we are getting close to our time. And I just have one kind of last question for you. I read the book, The Lorax, to my kids. And it's actually kind of what inspired a little bit of the branding and the naming of this podcast. And What's interesting about this book is at the end, a child gets handed a seed, and the story is that one child can make a difference. And people often are really struggling with climate, and they're struggling because they don't know what they can do. Where do they start? How do they get involved? Even businesses, a lot of people are thinking about that. But if you look around it is always usually an individual, somebody like yourself, or it's somebody else that's looking at new technology or, starting a different brand that's focused on it. So when you hear that, what can people do? What comes to mind for you?
I think that's such a great question. And climate is so complex. And I think that this is the type of issue where it really is important that if you feel motivated to work on climate or to get involved in some way, you get really curious about what that would look like for you. And you figure out what is your unique skill set? What is the unique thing that you have to offer to this problem? There was a really great TED Talk done by Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson that is now available, I think, on their website, that I would highly recommend everybody go and look at. I had the pleasure of going to TED this year and doing her exercise in person, where she had everybody walk through their own personal kind of what are you good at? What do you have to offer? And get creative about how to apply yourself to the issue. Because I think there is this problem in climate where there has actually been a fair bit of marketing around the impact of everyone's personal footprint. And while I absolutely think that it's really important that we all, minimize use of plastic, minimize fossil fuel consumption, and do our best to be the most ecologically minded citizens as we can be, it's a fallacy to say that personal footprint is what's causing climate change largely. It's largely down to the influence of large companies that are contributing the largest amounts of pollution to our atmosphere and aren't making changes quickly enough to reduce emissions and purchase carbon removal for the emissions they can't abate. And I think we need to put political pressure on those companies and on our governments to make really meaningful commitments to reversing climate change. But it's just not that exciting for everyone to call their local congresspeople or senators, and that's not going to work for everybody. I think if you're the type of person and where that works for you, do it. Like, get as involved as you can in your local and national government and trying to make a change on policy. But if that's not for you, and if you're really disenchanted by the personal footprint idea in the way that I am, I would really recommend spend some time thinking about what your unique give is to the system and to the problem. And again, great resources is that TED Talk to kind of walk through a really actionable framework for that.
Well, thank you, Kelly. Where can people find you, find more information about Project Vesta? How can we follow along, and what can people do to kind of help?
Yeah, check out our website. Our website is vesta.earth. You can follow along with us there. We're pretty constantly posting updates. We have, all the social channels, LinkedIn, Instagram, all of that, Twitter. So you can follow along there. If you're a newsletter type of person, we have a not that frequent, but sometimes newsletter. So yeah, get in touch with us and follow along. We are a nonprofit, so we are always, you know, raising donations and things. So if you're someone who can donate, or if you know philanthropists who might be interested in supporting our cause, definitely send them our way as well.
Thank you, Kelly. And obviously, best of luck with everything that you're doing. I don't think you need any luck. You're you're well on your way to do something. And I'm just really excited to hear and follow along this story. It's I love to see entrepreneurs like yourself that are chasing some really, really, really big problems. We need big problems to be solved. So thank you to you and your team. And thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you to you. Pleasure talking with you.
This podcast is co-produced with The Brand is Female. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Someone Like You. And if you did, please share this. We're a new podcast, and I would love it if you could share it with a family member, friend, colleague, work colleague, share it on Slack, whoever you do, just share and spread the message of these incredible brands. Please also support these type of companies. They're doing the hard thing, and the hard thing often takes a lot of people to get on board. And don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. I'm Marco Pimentel. Thank you for joining us today. For more information on Someone Like You, you can find us on Instagram at Someone Like You Podcast, with all the links to the podcast, our website, and more information about the brands that we feature. Thank you again.